You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and welcome to Episode 8 of the City of Man podcast, a show which tries to examine politics from the vantage of traditional Christian conviction. Yes, we are mixing religion and politics. We do not recommend that you try this at home. Coyle and I are trained professionals. I am Edward Song, an associate professor in the philosophy department at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. With me is the aforementioned Coyle Neal, an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. How's it going, Coyle?
It's going pretty well. How are you, Ed?
I am good. Our semester has wound down. I think you are in the midst of final exams. Is that right?
By the time this episode drops, the semester will be over. So
Excellent. Now, Southwest Baptist University, both Southwest Baptist University and Westmont College are members of the Coalition of Christian Colleges and Universities. That's like, for those who aren't familiar with the world of Christian higher education, that's like the major organization for evangelical schools in the country. Both schools are evangelical. Both of our schools are evangelical in their orientation. Southwest Baptist is obviously a Baptist school. And so, Coyle, I have an important question to ask you.
What's that, Ed?
Can you guys dance?
Not very well. But yes, we can. That was actually a question I asked when I interviewed for a job here. Can my wife and I, if we want to go out dancing, are we allowed to do that? And along with that, are we allowed to drink? Not that either of us really drink much, but it was a question that we were sort of curious as to what the answer would be. And the dean who was interviewing me said, "Oh yeah, we're fine with that. In fact, I teach the PE class on dancing here at the school."
Uh-huh.
So it's something that's been around for a while. I don't actually know when they started offering
it. And this PE class that he teaches, is this like some kind of medieval...
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't ask for details. I think it's a swing and waltz and the more sort of 1950s and back style dancing.
Okay.
I don't know for sure. I didn't ask for details about that.
Uh-huh. So touching is involved, but maybe not gyrating of hips.
Yes, it is... Yeah, so there's some kind of structure, and of course it's in the classroom environment and so on. I think the theater department might even have a modern dance.
Something. Uh-huh. Program, yeah.
A class. I don't think there's a whole program.
Okay.
But don't hold me to that. I might just be making that up. But the big news for us is this semester, Southwest Baptist had its first officially sanctioned student dance, which, you know, in our 120, 30, whatever, however long we've been around, year history, that's the first time that's ever happened. So,
wow. Sorry. And this, in fact, it happened already. It already happened.
They did have it off campus.
Uh-huh.
As sort of a nod to the more traditionally minded folks.
Uh-huh.
But we're now a dancing school.
And the world hasn't come to an end?
I don't think anyone thought the world would come to an end. I think, honestly, probably the last however many years, it's been more of a logistical issue than anything else. Than a theological one.
Uh-huh.
I know that the people involved in making the decision were all like, yeah, no one's ever really tried to do this before or recently, rather than a, you know, diehard objection to it.
And at this dance that just happened, were they playing the satanic rock music or?
I have absolutely no idea. Okay. I was not there. So
it wasn't like Renaissance madrigals or whatever you call it.
You know, they do a madrigal dinner here too. Which is actually a lot of fun. So, you know, if you've never done one of those, you definitely should.
I don't really know what that is. That's just like a word that I...
It's a Renaissance-style dinner.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's like, the place? Medieval Times. It's like Medieval Times, but scaled down, without the horses and sword fights.
Uh-huh. Okay. And on the drinking, can you all enjoy a glass of wine in your own home?
If you are over 21 and you are not on campus, you can. You're obviously not allowed to break the law, so no public drunkenness or driving under the influence or anything like that.
Students as well? If I was a senior and I was 21 and I lived off campus?
I don't know. I don't know if they agree that while they're students, they won't, or if they just say if you're over 21, that it's allowed. I don't know what the rule is there. Because I'm not a student, so, you know, I don't have to know that rule.
These are important things for you to know. You got to.
I know whether or not I can drink, even though I choose not to. I know what the answer there is.
Okay. I think we've been able to dance for maybe 10 or 15 years or so, or something.
Okay, so you're ahead of the curve out there.
Something like that.
Is Westmont Westmont's not a Baptist school, right?
No, it's non-denominational. I mean, they identify as evangelical Protestant, but there's no particular denomination.
Fair enough.
Anyways, after spending our first few episodes looking at the political philosophies of the dominant streams in contemporary American political life, we have tried to turn and take a little bit more of a theological take more recently, looking at the theme of justice in the Bible in our last episode. And we want to continue on that more explicitly theological track this week by looking at issues of the relationship between the church and the state, a topic of great importance, maybe especially these days. Cole, you want to kick us off and get this conversation going?
We mentioned sort of in passing last time that the church is an institution that looks in many ways like a state. So if you think about your own local church where you go on Sundays or Wednesday nights or whenever, it has members, it has an authority structure, it has powers that it is required to exercise, it has responsibilities towards its membership, its members have responsibilities towards it. It has a physical location whenever its membership is gathered together. I don't necessarily mean that there is a church building, but I mean that there is a place where the church meets when you have a gathering of the church, which gives Christians something of a challenge since our primary institutional obligation is to this institution. That is, we are Christians who are members of a local church or members of a church before we are members of any other institution, right? Be that your local Elks Club or Elks Lodge or the Kiwanis or the city of whatever town you live in or the nation or what have you. That's where our primary obligation lies. That institution is the one we should look at first, not the institution that has all of the guns and all of the policy platforms. But we also have obligations to the government, right? Civil society also has a claim on us, even a biblical claim on us. A claim that we can't just say, well, because my primary institution, my primary allegiance is to the state, I don't have to care, is to the church, I don't have to care what the state says. We have both obligations, right? We have both things that we're supposed to be paying attention to. So what we want to do today is think about how and where these two institutions get along, places they're going to butt heads, and how they sort of generally put our lives in a tension that Christians have really never successfully resolved. And obviously, I think that will apply to you and me, too. I don't think we're going to solve this if, Augustine and Luther and Calvin and all of those guys couldn't solve it. I don't imagine we will either. I think there are two big categories that it's helpful to put these different issues in, two sort of ways of looking at things. The first is with the idea of the institutional church as sovereign, and the second is with the idea of the institutional church as a model. So the idea of the church as sovereign, again, it resembles a state, as I just said, in the sense that there are obligations it has, there are powers that it exercises, and there are things it's supposed to do that it's not really allowed not to do, that it must do. So if we want to break that sovereignty into two areas, there's the area of interaction with the state that we as Christians say we would like the state to do this thing, but we realize we may or may not get our way on it, right? So that's basically everything we said in the last episode, right? We would like the state to create a welfare state to care for the poor on your side, or to encourage private charity and facilitate private giving on my side, right? Those are things we would like to see the government doing. We realize that the reality of the world is such that that may or may not happen, right? It just depends on what state you're living in, what the governmental structure is, all sorts of factors go into that. That is not a given, that is not a guarantee. So those are things we ask for, things we work for, things that we realize are sort of beyond our power. So policy preferences, the idea of not being persecuted. I think most Christians would prefer that. Most Christians would like not to be taxed for being Christians. If you live in a nation that's governed by Sharia law, there's a tax that's placed on Christians in the state. I would prefer not to have to pay that tax. Again, we sort of realize that that's just not how the world works. And obviously, Christians have differed through the years over how these over how we pursue these different goals. How do we work for that in the state? Should we have a state church that's sort of bound up with the state that pursues these different goals? Should we withdraw completely? And our primary point of interaction there is through prayer, right? In the more Anabaptist tradition. I think most Christians fall kind of in between those. Most Christians aren't going to be on the state church side of things. Most Christians aren't going to be on the total withdrawal side of things. Most are going to fall down somewhere in the middle. And again, we totally disagree, we largely disagree over what we ought to pursue. What policies should we be working for? Ed, anything to add there? Have I missed anything in that list or that categorization of stuff we'd like to see but may or may not get?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that strikes me is that bit that you finished up there, in that different theological traditions are going to have very different pictures of what that interaction with the state is going to look like. So it's certainly true that most Christians these days, well, this is a little bit of a complicated question. Most Christians these days aren't going to argue for Christendom again and just the marriage of church and state again. Oliver O'Donovan, who we mentioned last time, is sort of famous for arguing for a kind of a Christendom, though I think those arguments are sometimes misunderstood. But maybe the closest analog of that would be those Christians who think that the state ought to support or encourage religious adherence in a variety of ways, either symbolically in terms of pledges of allegiance, sure, or Ten Commandments in courthouses or other kinds of religious symbolization in public avenues. And then the other extreme is going to be that more Anabaptist view that wants to argue that the very nature of the state itself, the state is defined by its monopoly on the legitimate use of force, which is just to say that the state operates by coercion. Coercion is evil and wrong. Christians should have nothing to do whatsoever with the state. And you can see that attitude manifest in a whole bunch of different ways. Obviously, the most dramatic are going to be those religious traditions like the Amish or Mennonites, who take very separatist attitudes, right? And again, the whole idea is that Christians are called to stand apart from all of that, and through their separateness and the testimony of their lives together, stand in prophetic witness to all of the evil of the world.
Right. And even then, there's still, I mean, I'm not Amish, but I assume they would prefer that the state not come in and wipe them out. But they also understand that might happen.
And that they shouldn't resist.
And it's the pacifist side steps in and says, if this does happen, we will allow it, and we will not engage in violent revolution. So I guess if you want to put this in the extreme way of saying it, there are things that we would like to see the state do that we were unwilling to, or that in general Christians are unwilling to actively fight for outside of the law, if that makes sense. These are things that, if tomorrow, the United States passes an evangelical Christian tax, I will fight within the law because I have rights. I have the right to do that in this country. But at the end of the day, if I lose that fight, I'll pay the tax. Mm-hmm. I would prefer not to, but if that's the law, that's the law. That's what I have to do.
Right. And of course, in this country, we have the option of engaging in political debate in a way in which they don't in, say, North Korea.
Right. Right. So we are free to engage in that debate, and that's a good thing. But if that freedom goes away tomorrow, again, that's one of those places where we say, well, we wish we had that. We realize we don't, depending on what the freedom is, what freedom they're taking away.
Can I ask, Coyle, do you have a view on that former kind of a view, the more Christendom kind of view?
I do. So I when I was at Catholic University, there's an institute attached to Catholic University called the John Paul II Institute. Mm-hmm. And one of the professors there, whose name is escaping me, it's like David Schneider or David Schindler or something like that, is basically a radical Catholic, I don't know what the right phrase is, dominionist, I guess.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he thinks that the Pope, if I'm remembering this is the right guy, I never had a class with him, but this gentleman, I guess I shouldn't even attach a name to it, thinks that the Pope is the rightful king of the world, and the nations of the world ought to bow down to him, politically, not religiously. And the fact that we aren't is sinful. He doesn't go as far as to encourage, you know, violent revolution against governments that won't do that, but he does say, look, this is not the way it ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is counter to basically everything we see in Scripture about the state. I think we're told pretty explicitly that the church and the state are separate entities, as our sign-off says. You know, there are things that are Caesar and things that are God's. And even though, yes, they are ultimately all God's in the grand scheme of things, in this life, there's a distinction there. So it would be inappropriate for my local pastor to go to the mayor of my local town and start giving him instructions. He can go as a citizen and say, hey, look, this is what I think you ought to be doing, but I think it would be wildly inappropriate for him to say, you know, here are your orders. They come from the Lord through me to you.
Mm-hmm.
How about you? Do you have any?
Well, yeah, so I'm down on Christian dominionism. Yeah, so on the classic Roman Catholic, I mean, you undoubtedly know more about this than I do, having studied at a Catholic institution. It's funny, you're like, you're Baptist, but you went to grad school at Catholic University. I'm Protestant, but in some ways kind of Anglo-Catholic in my ecclesiology. But anyways.
So you'd be okay with the Pope being in charge of the United States?
Well, yeah, you know, so my view is, like, my view, I take the Catholic view that when Jesus says to Peter about handing him the keys to the kingdom, right? That key verse that Roman Catholics seize upon as seeing Peter as having a special kind of authority, right? So that's anointing Peter as Pope. And Peter has, as Pope, as the Bishop of Rome, has a special kind of authority. I think that's right. Like, I think, like, when you look at the kingdom language and talk of keys, like, I think it's clear that he's bestowing upon Peter a special kind of authority, and you can see that authority played out in the life of the church in Acts and in the Jerusalem Council and all the sort of deference that is shown to Peter in those books. So I think that's right.
Over into the political state.
Oh no. Well, and let me just also finish this line, lest it sound like I'm more Roman Catholic than I am. But then I think the church gets corrupt. I think the Reformation was a proper response to that. I think it would have been better if the church had been reformed within the institutions, but that wasn't possible, so the Reformation happened. But I think, like, that authority structure, I believe in not just an invisible church, I believe in a visible church. And I think that it would be better if we were sort of reunited under a visible church, albeit one whose theology is more Protestant-looking. Anyways.
So do you then transfer the keys from the Pope? Does that imply political sovereignty?
Oh, and so getting back to, no. So I don't think it does. But yeah, under that classic Roman Catholic picture of authority, God grants authority to the church, and the state is under the church. So, I mean, I again, you know a lot more about this stuff than I do. But you can, I suppose you can draw a distinction between the state and what the state does, and the church and what the church does. But on that classic picture, the church holds authority over everything that's under it, including the state.
Right. So in the sort of later medieval Catholic view, and you got to qualify it that way, because this is not something, obviously not something that the church that early Christians believed, because the Roman Empire was pagan and they were being persecuted, mm-hmm. And it's not something they believed in the early Middle Ages, at least in any broad sense. Because the world was just fragmented, and you don't even really have church unity at that point. So to say that the church ought to rule, it's a much, much later development. But yeah, I I would not agree with that at all. I would say that there is a political role for the church to play, but it's not one of command and power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we don't disagree on that.
Well, there you go. Other than it sounds like we disagree about the structure of the church.
Oh, yeah.
The keys of the church, I think, are pretty clearly given to the local congregation there in Matthew 18.
Ah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Which we will undoubtedly talk more about in a second. Anything else to add?
No. Why don't you keep on trucking?
Yeah, so again, we've got that that category of, again, this first category of stuff that we'd like to see, but we don't expect it to happen. And then the second category of church sovereignty is the category of stuff that for lack of a better way to say it, we won't compromise on. So there are things that the world does them, we think they're wrong, but we understand that happens. But then there are things that, as Christians, as members of an institutional church, we say the state has no right to involve itself here. So a few examples of this, control over our own institutional boundaries. However, Anglo-Catholic you may be in your doctrine, it's one thing to say maybe the church ought to have some authority over the state. I don't know anyone who says the state, any Christian who says the state ought to have authority over the church. I don't know anyone who turns that around, I suppose, other than Henry VIII. But even he only pushed that so far. Control over our own institutional boundaries, the idea of declaring who is a Christian and who is not a Christian through the use of membership. That is something that the state has no voice in. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be a big issue in the next few years. So we've seen this in parachurch organizations, which I should also draw a distinction between the parachurch organizations fall in that first category. So what happens to Campus Crusade for Christ? What happens to InterVarsity or Navigators or any of those other organizations out there that I think are doing some very, very good work? Mm-hmm. That's in the we would like to see, but if things we don't like happen, they happen. We're not going to resist that in outside the law. But this is a big one. So a question like, does my local church have to admit to its membership an unrepentant homosexual who comes along and says, I would like to join your organization? Well, the classic Christian answer is no one can answer that but the church. The state does not have a voice. So if the state comes along and says, we are going to dictate the terms under which you will admit people to membership, our response as Christians is, you don't get to do that. Right? Right or wrong, that's an internal decision, and that's one of those things we stand on. Related to that, another thing that's sort of a non-negotiable, control over the content of our teaching. So what is proclaimed as official doctrine from the pulpit? What is the statement of faith of the church? What do we teach as necessary to get into heaven? What do we teach in terms of social policy? All of those sorts of things. We have again said the state has no voice when it comes to that. We've already seen this. If you remember, was this last year or the year before when you had the kerfuffle in Houston, where you have the city pass the ordinance about sexual discrimination, and then you have the pastors preaching on taking sort of various traditional stances about sexual orientation, and then the mayor and the attorney for the city demanding that the pastors turn over the transcripts of their sermons. Mm-hmm. Which obviously was a very symbolic gesture because I think all of these churches had their sermons posted online anyway. But that idea of somehow the city may dictate to the church what is said in its theology, that's another place where Christians are going to resist. That's a place where we're going to basically say whatever laws the state passes, we keep control of this. This is internal to us. And again, we're going to see that come up more and more. One of the questions that gets asked every election season, if my local pastor comes out and endorses one of the main candidates for president from the pulpit on a Sunday morning, so not like a special meeting during the week that's open to the community or whatever, but in a church service, does that count as campaigning or not? Well, if it's campaigning, we have this entire body of campaign laws that may or may not come into play. If it's not campaigning and if it's religion, then those laws don't apply. And again, as unwisely as people can use that at times, I think I certainly fall down on the, maybe it is open campaigning, but again, the state does not get to say what is or is not a religious teaching. Ed, anything to add on those first two?
Yeah, so I don't really disagree with that. I guess I just to problematize that a little bit, like, are there points in which the boundaries of what is within the state's proper authority start to bounce up against things that are under the church's authority. So if you had, Christian white nationalist groups.
Right.
Which exist. Yes, they do. Well, yes, they do.
I would question whether or not they're actually Christian, but yeah.
Well, we might both do that, but that's how they identify anyways, right?
Right.
And, Or you could flip it around and or what about radical Islamic mosques that are advocating violence against the state or something like that?
Right.
These are tricky areas in which, you know, religious teaching is going to start to bounce up against areas of the church that.
Right. Or the so again, we have those parachurch organizations where this battle is currently being fought. So if I'm, if I'm the administrator of a Roman Catholic hospital, and through Obamacare, some of my employees are employed or covered with health insurance that provides for abortions. Mm-hmm. Well, do I have a say in that sort of practice based mm-hmm. on my religious conviction? Now that again, that's a parachurch thing. So traditionally, I think I'm going to say that's in that first category. We would like the state not to coerce us to do that, but we understand that that sort of thing might happen. Uh-huh. If it comes to be the case that the state is now mandating that we provide that for people within our congregation. You know, if we had some kind of health insurance for our congregation, mm-hmm. which we don't, but if mm-hmm. we had something like that, and the state came along and said, "Hey, we're going to require you to do this," then I think that would be a place where biblically I could say, no, we're not violating our conscience there. Mm-hmm. That's a stand we're willing to take. I was reading a history of the church in North Korea, and there's this interesting event in the early 1930s. The Japanese were occupying North Korea, and they nominally, on paper, had freedom of religion. In practice, ancestor worship was the sort of common thing of the day, and every town had a little shrine that everyone was supposed to go and worship at. And of course, the Christians there refused to do that. So they, mm-hmm. the Japanese government called, I think these were Presbyterians, so they called a synod. The Japanese government said, "All right, assemble your pastors and your elders." They sent in the military and physically restrained everyone from speaking except for the people who stood up and said, "We're going to allow members of our churches to make these sacrifices at these shrines because it's just a political statement rather than a religious statement." Mm-hmm. So that's sort of an extreme example, but it kind of highlights the place where we would say, that is not okay in any sense, but especially in the sense that the state doesn't get to define what Christian doctrine is. Mm-hmm. Other things that we tend to care about, unless you had anything to add.
No, go ahead.
So other things we won't compromise on, control over the internal workings of the church, selection of leaders, internal processes, relationships with other churches, extra church hierarchy and synods, parishes, and so on. So whether your church is Congregational or Presbyterian or Methodist or Episcopalian or Catholic or whatever, those sorts of decisions are decisions, again, that are made by the church and not by the state. So we see this come up. Especially again to go back to the example of gay marriage, in many states, pastors, in a sense, act as agents of the state when they sign wedding licenses. Mm-hmm. So you usually have to be sort of registered with the state as a pastor. But mm-hmm. the question has been brought up in the past of who actually counts as a pastor. Well, again, that is a thing that ultimately, I think, the state cannot decide. That's something that only the church itself can decide, which means that, interestingly, you have the state basically outsourcing, in some ways, this responsibility to an institution that it has no control over. That may stop at some point, but for now, it has largely been the case that the state has kind of said, "Yeah, send us whoever your pastors are, and we by and large won't question that."
Yeah, well, and pastors is pretty broadly construed, right?
It is very broadly construed. That could mean everything from, every elder in your local church to the regional bishop. I mean, it's a huge word.
Well, I mean, it could mean like a secular humanist organization.
Sure, sure. And I would imagine different states have different laws about how that works. I don't know the nuts and bolts there. I've tended to think about this from the church side rather than from the state side. And related to that, another broad word, the processes within the church for bringing people into membership and excluding them from membership. So excommunication basically is what that's talking about, and control over how that works. Yet again, another thing that the church says, we get to decide who is inside our body and who is outside of it. That's an internal process that each church is going to have its own variation of. Each church is going to have its own method of doing that, just depending on where you are. Again, we're going to see lawsuits over this without doubt, if they're not already in the courts, if they're not already working their way through as the various issues that our society is struggling with come more and more to the forefront. Questions of, can we exclude someone from the congregation for being unrepentant about, pick your sin of the week? Is that the sort of thing that's allowed? Again, the traditional Christian answer is yes, we can. And then finally, the right to assemble. I suppose it's possible. This is not something that I foresee in the immediate future in the United States, but theoretically you could have a government that says, yes, total freedom of religion on paper, but you're not allowed to meet. You can have whatever religion you want as long as you stay home and keep it to yourself. The Christian life is a corporate life, which means that we need to meet physically with other people. We need to spend time, however often that is, and in whatever location that is, with others in our institution. This is more of an issue in sort of the developing world, where you have a big fear of large assemblies of people because they tend to get out of control and turn into riots or turn into revolutions. So if you've been following in the past month, I guess, past couple of weeks, the guy in charge of China, I have no idea, is he the president or the premier, party chairman? I don't know what his title is.
I think he's all of those things, right? It's like multiple titles.
Right. The general secretary. Let's use the good Soviet word. Has basically come out and said we are going to start reigning in these Christian churches.
Yeah.
Ways that has been done in the past, not necessarily just in China, but various places, is to set a cap on the number of people you can have meeting in any one place.
Yeah.
That raises interesting sort of ethical questions, like. I believe a Christian church has a right to assemble. I think that is something, that is a place where we would resist the state. They told us you're not allowed to meet. But what if the state says something like, fine, you can meet, but no more than 200 people at any one time. Mm-hmm. No more than 1,000 people, no more than whatever. I don't have an answer to that. I don't know where something like that would fall.
Yeah, and I mean, just a super small point. I mean, yeah. what you mean to say, right, is could resist.
What do you mean?
As opposed to would resist. Like, surely that's a matter of discretion for individual churches, right?
Yeah, I mean, what do you mean? I guess I should make sure I understand your question.
I mean, you're not suggesting, so let's say you and I were Chinese Christians.
Right.
And we meet in a small house church and they pass a law that says you can't have more than 20 people. I wouldn't necessarily say that we were violating the obligations that we have as Christians if we chose to comply with that law out of reasons of prudence.
No, I think I would agree with that. Now, if your response is, if the law is you're not allowed to meet at all, that's when I might say, okay, as a Christian, now I have an obligation to disobey that law. And I, mm-hmm. With all due respect to people who are in far, far worse situations than I will likely ever be in, living in, red state rural America, I realize that there are questions of prudence and persecution is of course terrible. But I also think the Bible is fairly clear about a lot of these things in terms of, not so much, I mean, again, as we said last time, the Bible doesn't have a whole lot to say explicitly about politics, but in terms of who gets to set up the membership, who gets to set up the teaching, who gets to control the internal workings of the state. It's not the government, right? It's.
Oh, yeah, well, so there's no doubt about that, but that's a little bit of a different question about how we should negotiate tensions when the church... So, I mean, if the state is demanding idolatry, so that's kind of one thing, but...
Right, so we're not dealing with those, at least at our particular historical moment, we're not dealing with the state coming along and saying, you will worship Baal. Are we dealing with the state coming along and saying, you will not teach that abortion is a sin, or you will not teach that homosexuality is a sin, or transgenderism is a sin, or anything like that? That's the moment we seem closer to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess I'm mainly thinking about persecuted Christians in other parts of the world,
right,
that are facing real physical violence and death because of their religious beliefs.
Right. And
and I wouldn't want to suggest that they're violating their obligations of as Christians if they fail to go to church every Sunday, or if they...
Right. No, obviously that's the case. All contingencies being reasonably accounted for, of course. Well, anything else to add on the church's sovereign ed?
No. You want to talk about the church as a model?
Yeah. So we will be talking a lot more about this. We'll be covering a book and hopefully getting Jonathan Lehman on the show down the road at some point this summer. The book Political Church is the one to look at here. But just briefly, a few things about the church as a model. Not only does the church have all of its own internal practices, its own teachings, and so on, but the church also stands as a representative to the state. We are, I think Lehman calls it, an embassy of God's kingdom to the world. So a church that's well-run is a picture of what the state should be. That mutual care, that mutual charity, that concern and involvement in each other's lives in a way that nudges each other towards the good, towards greater faith, towards a love of God, and so on. That is what the state should be doing. A state that's well-run is a picture of what the church, I think, will be someday, post-return of Christ and so on. In the in-between, while we're waiting on that to happen, we... as a church, as an institution, act as ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven. We're an outpost of the eschaton, albeit a very flawed and sinful one. I don't think we could ever claim that we're somehow perfect, right? We are a picture of who God is and what he has done, but we're still sinners. And part of that picture is our role in the state. I think theologians talk about this as the prophetic role. So we do things like we point out sin, we warn of judgment for it, we point people to the cross, and we hold out the offer of forgiveness. In a sense, our job is to steal citizens from the state. Our job is to steal allegiance from the United States of America to the kingdom of God, to bring people into this tension we live in. If you want to look at it from sort of the political point of view, our job is to confuse people's lives by telling them that there is something more important than the corporate life of the nation. These things, the church's prophetic role and the church's representative role, obviously feed into each other, right? We represent God's character to the world when we tell the world about who he is. When we tell the world about who he is, we are modeling, we're displaying God. Anything to add? Anything to bring into that?
Yeah. So I think everything that you said there is correct. I would also add that it's not just sort of standing in, like, pointing out sin or warning of judgment, right? But it is also through our collective life together.
Yeah.
And the love that Christians show for each other and for the world that sort of points to a better way. So, neither you nor I are Anabaptists, but, that's the bit in Anabaptist talk, like in Stanley Hauerwas is probably, he's one of the most important and famous theologians. Neither you nor I are Anabaptists, but where I find, like, the Anabaptist writings particularly compelling is when they talk about the life of the church standing in prophetic witness to the world, not only in judgment, but in love.
Right.
And the love that we show for each other and the love that we extend out into the world. And maybe in some ways that's particularly important in in modern America, in which, I mean, the United States is nothing if not individualistic. And it's very easy for Christians to sort of think about the way in which they engage the world as being fundamentally about sort of individual versus world, or individual towards other individual. But like, I think that's false. It's interesting. I don't know if you're going to disagree with this or not, but I would say, now obviously we are individuals.
Sure.
And it's not as if
I don't disagree with that.
Good. Okay. So next thing. But I would say that the primary mode of engagement of Christians towards the world is through the church, right? We engage the world through the church. We are first and foremost members of the people of God, and we engage the world as members of the people of God.
Absolutely. And
we're not.
Sorry, go ahead.
No. Go on.
Yeah, so I was just
going to say that we're not lone ranger Christians sort of out there winning people for Christ on our own. We are members of the church.
Right. So all of the things, so when we talk about the church's prophetic role in the state, pointing out sin, warning, judgment, pointing to forgiveness, we should, of course, model that individually. We should also model that corporately. So when we point out sin, we should, with our words, obviously say, hey, this is what God says in his word sin is. But we also model that by repenting of it in our own lives and repenting of it as a corporate body. When we warn of judgment, that again is something we do with our words, right? It's something we do using what God has given us in Scripture, but it's also something we remind each other of in a corporate body as a church. And when we point out to the cross, when we offer forgiveness, and when we live the lives of love that we're called to, all of those things are things that we do individually and in the corporate body, and that's what the world should see, is that dual model. It should see sinners who are trying individually very hard not to be sinners. It should see a collection of sinners in a church trying very hard to encourage each other not to be sinners and to care well for each other's needs, both physical and spiritual, right? Both in terms of, if there are poor people in our church, we need to be helping to care for them. And if there are sinners in our church, which there certainly are because it has people in it, we need to be encouraging them to resist that sin and to believe the gospel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is one of the areas in which I think the English language betrays us a little bit, because there's no obvious difference between the second person singular and the second person plural.
Right.
Right? Where, like, in, I mean, I don't know, maybe every other language, there's like a different word, right? And so many times in, say, Paul's letters, in which he's saying you, right? It's almost never you, Coyle, or you, Ed.
Right.
It's you all.
It's
right?
y'all.
Yeah. So I said, yeah. And so, yeah, if there were Southern translations of the Bible.
There are Southern translations of the Bible.
Yeah.
They're not very good, but they get that part right.
Yeah. Yeah. Y'all. All y'all.
Right.
I think that's important. I wanted to ask you a question, but I didn't want to interrupt your exposition. Do you want to
go for it.
So, you know, you've talked a little bit about the nature of the church and the sort of sovereignty that the church needs to, that is an essential part of the church's nature, and the role of the church as being a model. You know, and whenever you talk about the church, this gets to the bit that we were talking about earlier. I mean, you're always talking about the local congregation.
Yes.
And our obligations being to the local congregation. And this has come up in other times that you've talked. Like, when you've talked about meeting the needs of the poor, it's almost always talking about it in the context of the poor in our church, in my local congregation. And so I guess I wanted to ask you about that and the extent to which our obligations... You know, so there's the little C church and the capital C church, and our obligations to both, and how you thought about those things.
Yeah. So when I was a younger Christian, I can't exactly claim to be an old or a mature Christian yet. But when I was a younger Christian, I was very big on my obligations are to the Big C Church, to the Kingdom of God, to the Church Invisible. I mean, there are any number of ways that you could, to heaven. I mean, there are any number of ways that you can talk about that. Mostly out of arrogance because I was younger, but also because of some bad theology that I had imbibed when I was growing up. Not that it was explicitly taught by anyone at the churches I was a member of, but because it was sort of in the evangelical culture of the 90s. This idea of, we don't want to get too hung up on the institutional church, we just want to love Jesus and work for his kingdom. Well, the primary point that you and I have to work for the kingdom of God in this life is our local church. I mean, that is place number one. Now, that's not to say, you know, you have no obligations to anyone else ever. If you also want to work for caring for the poor in a third world country, awesome, fine, go for it. If you are doing that instead of caring for the poor in your local church, I think you're in clear violation of the commands of Scripture. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not going to disagree in when you say our primary obligation is to our local congregation. But then that second bit that you said sounded really strong to me. So if I feel like I'm called to do missionary work in Central America and help the needy there, I think what you just said was that I don't want to put words in your mouth. I can't remember how you said it, but I'm clearly violating the obligations of Scripture or something.
So one of the things I think that Scripture is pretty clear that should happen is that missions work needs to go on, right? I mean, we have the Great Commission. I tend to think that the best way to do that is by local churches sending out missionaries who then establish other local churches. So the missionary is sort of the beginning of a local church, right? The missionary is the one who kicks that off. And I know so little about missions. I don't know that I would want to say anything about it beyond that. The guy to read on that, blanking on his name, is a pastor in Dubai, Max Stiles, I think is. So obviously in a mission setting, who spent a lot of time thinking about what does it mean to be a missionary who believes that the local church is sort of the primary point. From the perspective of the local church sending out missionaries, I think that means that you should do a good job supporting them. I think that it's important that churches are very supportive of their missionaries, but I would be hesitant about someone who claimed to be a missionary but had no support from the church they're from. I don't know that I want to push that too hard, but if a member of my congregation says, I want to be a missionary, will you guys send me or not? I think our church is probably going to say yes, but I also think that our church exercises judgment over who we send out as missionaries.
Sure, sure.
So someone that the congregation just says, look, we appreciate your intent, but we don't think you're gifted in that way. I think the right response might be not to be a missionary then. Just as if someone in our congregation were to say, well, I think I should be the pastor. And I would like to remove the current pastor and put myself in his place. There might be a process for that technically on the books, but if the congregation says no, I'm going to be suspicious if that person keeps trying. Is that making sense?
Yeah. And I don't think I disagree with any of that. But just sometimes, like, there is this really intense kind of localness in the way that you talk about the church. And again, like, you know, I don't disagree that, like, we primarily live out our lives as Christians, as members of particular congregations. But I also think that it's, yeah, and so I don't know if you're going to disagree with this, but sometimes there's a kind of an intensity in that talk that just seems like really strong to me.
So I feel like at this point I should escalate and say, I see in Scripture no authority structure no religious authority structure in this world beyond the level of the local congregation.
Well,
your Anglo-Catholic, your inner Anglo-Catholic should, like, go nuts at that.
So the Jerusalem Council. For one thing,
a gathering of the one church that existed.
So you're going to want to set aside all of that early church history.
No, depending on what you mean by early church history.
Early bishops.
Yeah, well, elected by their local congregation.
Uh huh.
It depends on what point you're talking about. Like this is one of those things that church historians sort of go round and round about, and it will, like, if you read about the early church will sound a lot like the ecclesiology of whichever church historian is doing the writing.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's a little, cynical, but...
Oh, no. I mean, it's largely... So if you're reading it, Roman Catholic history of the first three centuries, you're like, oh...
Oh, sure. No, yeah, sure. Yeah, but like...
First three centuries, I mean, it's... Baptists, I think, probably have a weaker claim to that because there are presbyters and elders and bishops and so on. But they're also... The Episcopal side of things also has a weaker claim because they're all internally elected by the congregation, not sent out by a higher authority or confirmed by higher authority until much later. So by the time you start getting to the 4th century, the 5th century, yes, then you start seeing those things. Mm-hmm. But at that point, we're, 400 years of development and adoption by the Roman Empire later. So there are many influences going on there.
Yeah. I mean, my point about the, like, that sounds cynical is... I mean, of course, a Roman Catholic commentator on particular is going to read that particular way. But, I mean, that's because he thinks that that argument is the most compelling, and he has reasons for thinking that, right? It's
Yep, same thing with the Baptist commentator who says exactly the opposite.
Well, yeah, and then the thing to do is sort of to wade into the arguments and try to see who gets the better of it.
And unfortunately, so one of my kind of long-term projects is reading through, that, like, 10-volume set of the Anti-Nicene Fathers that pops up for sale once in a while on the internet. Okay, so it's this assembled in the late 19th century. It's like all of the pre-Council of Nicaea writings. No. This is the Orthodox guys. So so Tertullian and Origen.
Ante. Okay.
And then there's like a post-Nicene Fathers also, so the people who come afterwards.
I thought you meant anti as in
right.
Against.
No. So these are the people who are mostly Orthodox with some weird guys here and there, Tertullian and Origen. So one of my longer-term projects has been to slowly read through that, in part because all of these discussions I had at Catholic University kind of being interested in, well, whose side are the documents on? And if you read them with that in mind, it is really frustrating because the stuff that we would like to know, they are just utterly unconcerned with. Like, they're writing about persecution and they're writing about, how to bear up in a pagan culture. They're not writing about what their members' meetings look like. And they're not writing about what their relationship is to the next church over. And they're not writing about, what's going on in baptism or in communion. So all of the things that divide Protestant and Catholic and Protestant from Protestant, it's all tangential and sort of mentioned as asides and assumed and...
Yeah, exactly.
So there's
well, because yeah, it just wasn't... Yeah. Well, that's not to say that there isn't a view, but just that the view is taken for granted.
Right. So right. Kind of the whose interpretation of that is right is an unanswerable question ultimately based on the evidence that we have. Mm-hmm. So were they Baptists or were they Episcopalians or were they Catholics or Presbyterians? They impossible to tell. At least so far, I've got 2 or 3 volumes left to go. So maybe there will be a big clincher in there that I'm like, oh well, clearly, clearly I was wrong or clearly I was right. I'm not all the way through yet. How on earth did we get on that? Oh, local congregation stuff.
Yeah. So we've been talking about the church, but then just different conceptions of what the church is.
Right. And I did try, as I was going through a lot of this, I did try to keep this vague. I think the church is sovereign, the church is model, whether your conception of the church is local congregation only or, synod or bishopric or parish system or whatever. I think those things all apply. It's just a question of how big an institution are you talking about? Like, how are you applying this to something that starts in Rome and goes down to your local level, or are you just applying it to your local congregation? In either case, we're going to say the state doesn't get to tell us who our good faithful Catholics are, who our good faithful Baptists are. Is that fair enough, mm-hmm. or do you think I've been too localist on this?
No. I think that's fair, and I think everything you said was relatively neutral. But sometimes, like, your considered view comes out, and then, I mean, that's just interesting.
Sure.
And also, I mean, it's probably also the case that depending upon how you think about those issues, that's going to influence the way in which you think about some of these things.
Yeah, and hopefully it would be mostly internal. So something like excommunication, you know, is that best done by a congregational vote, or is that best done by processes run by the elders or the priest? You know, that's mm-hmm. that's kind of an internal division between, you know, Baptist, Presbyterian, Methodist, Episcopalian, and so on. I think that would have some public policy ramifications, because of course if you're a state official trying to sort through all of that, that can be a challenge. But like I said, hopefully that's also still somewhat neutral, because whichever one we fall on, it shouldn't be the town council doing it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do we have obligations to help the needy who are not members of our church?
We have obligations that are there, but secondary. So yes, uh-huh. but they are sort of second tier obligations. I am of limited financial means, but if I have to pick between helping the elderly widow in my church that I have covenanted with and the elderly widow who lives across town from me, mm-hmm. and I only have the means to help one of them, I think my obligation is probably first and foremost to that elderly widow in the church.
Sure. So other things being equal, your obligation is to your
right.
fellow.
Again, there's as you pointed out in the last episode, there is always room for more charity, right? If I have means to help more than one person, and honestly, if I am doing something to, you know, guarantee that I don't have the means to help more than one person, if I am keeping my Netflix subscription and my Audible subscription and all of these other things instead of helping out my neighbors and doing that sort of on purpose, then there are certainly problems there. But yeah, so all and other things being equal, the people that I have sworn and confessed that I will help them, they're who I have obligations to first.
Sure. Presumably, if the need is greater outside of the church, that matters, right?
Yes. I think so. And I don't actually know what that would look like in a church that's more hierarchical. So if I were a member of a Catholic church, I don't know how Catholics look at their own obligations to their specific parish. As compared to other parishes, I have no idea what that looks like. That might be a place where it is very Baptist-centric, because I have specifically joined a congregation that I've said, you are the people that are holding me accountable. You're the people that are sort of encouraging me to live well, and I'm encouraging you hopefully the same way. And we're going to facilitate each other in a way that I haven't made that agreement with anyone else. Mm-hmm. What do you think? How would you break that obligation down?
Again, I don't think I would disagree with you, but like whenever you express our obligations to help those in need, you almost always express that in terms of, I have an obligation to help the needy in my church. And that's just always struck me, as opposed to, we have an obligation to help those who are in need around us.
Right. So it's not an exclusive obligation. I don't think. Again, I have not sort of gone through command by command in Scripture in the New Testament to see, you know, what are the obligations in the Old Testament of the nation of Israel to care for the poor in, you know, the nation of Assyria. I have never gone through with sort of that eye to things. If you read through 1 Corinthians, what are the obligations of the Corinthian church to care not only for the poor in their own congregation, but for the poor pagans. I don't know. I have not looked through that. I think they're there. I think that that general call for charity exists. But in terms of specific commands, I would be hesitant to say that someone is sinning if they are exclusively supporting their own church members. And that's all they have to
do. Yeah, I don't disagree with that. But that seems to sort of generate a priority. Again, if all you had the means to do was to help a single person, and you can either help two people whose material conditions are identical to each other, and one's in the church and one is out, then I don't disagree with you.
Right.
But...
well, maybe it would be helpful if we...
Just the thought is that just sort of seems to encourage a narrow view of who our neighbor is.
Right. Right. And certainly as a political scientist, then I would want to talk about civic virtue and helping your neighbor in the sense of who actually lives next door to you and in your own town and so on, as we talked about in the conservatism episode. But this is the one on Christianity, so I'm focusing more on the church there. I think it might be helpful. What if we switch the subject from, you know, almsgiving to church to discipline? Who am I responsible for in terms of something like excommunication? People in my own local institution or people outside of it? And that might be where the denominational boundaries matter a lot. I would say if I see someone who is sinning, who claims to be a Christian, who is sort of unrepentantly, you know, cheating on his wife, right? If that person is in my church, I think I have specific obligations that then come into play that culminate, if he refuses to repent, with the act of excommunication. If he is outside of my church, I think that excommunication thing isn't an option. Like, it's just a different set of requirements.
Well, yeah, but that's why those two scenarios, I think, are asymmetrical, right? Because they're just, there's nothing to be done about some unrepentant Christian who lives in, you know, 1,000 miles away from me and with whom I have no, there's no binding shared governance structure of any kind, right? There's like literally nothing that I can do. But that's not the case. So there's nothing to be done there, but that's not the case with regard to helping those who are in need, because there is something that I can do. And the thing where it gets extra punch is that obviously when you are a Christian living in 21st century America, I mean, there are people who live not far away from where I live who live in remarkable need, right? But that need pales in comparison to people who live in other parts of the world.
Absolutely.
Right? And I can help them, right?
Right.
In some ways, I can help them just as easily as I can help somebody who's in my own church or somebody who's in my own town. And their need is far more extreme. Anyways.
Yeah, and again, your obligations to your own church in no way negates that broader obligation as well. Right, again, assuming you have the means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have anything to say about establishment, disestablishment stuff? Like, you know, creches at Christmas or Ten Commandments on courthouse walls?
That would fall in that first category of, you know, if the state wants to do it, fine. If the state doesn't want to do it, I would sort of like them to, I guess. Well, I don't even know if I would like them to, depending on where you are. But if they don't do it, they don't do it. Like, that is not the sort of thing that you sneak down late at night and carve the Ten Commandments into the wall of your local courthouse. Like, that's not the hill to die on as a Christian.
Yeah, though people do stuff like that.
I know, and that's so frustrating. You know? Because you're like, oh, come on, but that's not, like, yeah.
So you don't take a strong view.
Well, again, within legal means. So
yeah,
if I
is that something that Christians should care about? I get, like, that's the point that I'm getting at. And so it seems like you're ambivalent about it. My view is like, no. Not only is that the kind of thing that Christians shouldn't care about, we have no business doing. Like, the state is the state. Why are we trying to why do we want the state trying to promote an understanding of what it is to be a Christian, right? What does that have to do with the state?
Unless so I'm down on all of that. To create a big welfare program based on your view of the Bible. In that case, you're okay with it.
I think the state should pursue justice. I don't know that it should be promoting piety.
But you've said justice and charity are the same thing. How is that not promoting piety?
You know, actually, I was thinking about the way that I put the point last time, and I was thinking, that's actually not what I mean to say. I mean to say that justice and charity are different things, and the Bible is talking about justice.
Right.
But anyways.
Once you broaden that up, should there be a Ten Commandments at the courthouse? I mean, if there's already one there, I don't have a problem with it being there. Should you go out of your way to try to put it there as if that will solve the problems of the moral decline of America? No, I don't think that's a practical response. I don't think that will actually fix anything, and it's just going to antagonize the people that, well, I may not care if they're antagonized because they're going to be upset about something anyway. It's not actually going to fix anything. So why not spend your energy and thought and effort focusing on other stuff that matters maybe more? It's sort of like, did you see the God's Not Dead movie?
No.
Oh, I'd be interested. If you get a chance to watch it, I would be interested in your thoughts on it as someone who teaches philosophy.
Is that the movie about the professor?
Yeah, with Kevin Sorbo as the professor. So if you want to see Hercules teaching philosophy very badly. But the worst part, I think, of that movie, like aside from, it's sort of a Christian movie, so the artistic quality is pretty low anyway. The worst part is that's not the challenge Christians are facing on college campuses. Like, what philosophy professor worth his salt is going to say, here's this issue I obviously care passionately about and think a lot about. We're not going to talk about it in class. Except when I turn the classroom over to a freshman. Like, it was ridiculous. Like, it didn't deal with any of the issues Christians are facing on college campuses.
I thought, like, that's... Lots of Christians think that that is what, in fact,
happened. And all that did is feed into that already existing Christian bias that does not line up with reality. But a movie about,
that Christians aren't persecuted
in the classroom.
Christians aren't persecuted for their religious beliefs in classrooms.
Yeah, so no, granted, a movie about, an administrative board meeting where it was decided that the campus, Christian student ministry organization is no longer allowed to use student facilities because they won't allow non-Christians to be in their leadership.
Yeah, yeah,
that wouldn't be nearly as exciting a movie. So I sort of get that. But, what's the real problem facing Christians on campus? It's that second one. It's not because the philosophy professor is an atheist. It's administrative stuff going on behind the scenes. One of the reasons I put it that way, I suppose, is my wife was at Ohio State when that started going down. I want to say she was the president of CLS at Ohio State, involved in the lawsuit. I mean, it was... like the original thing that started this all off, like the school that started the, if you're setting a religious standard for your student organization, we're not going to allow you recognize student activity membership, which they won because Ohio's a red state, or was at the time. But yeah, anyway, sorry, that's a long tangent.
Coyle, do you have anything else to add to all of this conversation?
No, I think we have said absolutely everything that could be said about church and state relationships. No, seriously, we've focused today mostly on the institutional side of things, church and state as institutions sort of colliding. We will do episodes down the road on specific issues. We'll talk about, 10 Commandments in the courthouse and religion on campus and all of those other things. The goal here was to provide more of a framework for the congregation, for the structured church running into the structured state. We'll get into details as the podcast proceeds over hopefully the next very long while.
Great. And speaking of how the podcast is going to proceed, up to this point, Coyle and I have been putting out an episode every week. But our plan is to move to a bi-weekly schedule, which we will shift to after this episode drops. So unfortunately, your commutes to work or your long runs you're gonna have to find something else to listen to for at least an extra week. So our next episode will drop in 2 weeks hence, and it looks like we're gonna try to do an episode on tolerance, civility, and smugness, which is inspired by another Vox article that was written on whether or not liberals are smug or not. So keep your ear out for that in a couple of weeks. But the City of Man is a proud member of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. I don't know how many specific shows they have, Coyle.
Dozens, I think. I feel like they add another one every couple of weeks.
There's the flagship Christian Humanist show. There is our show. There is the Christian Feminist show, which your wife is on. There's the Book of Nature, which is a faith in science show. There is the Sectarian Review, which is a new show.
There's the Profiles.
They do profiles and interviews of authors for recent books that have been written.
I mean, I think they're really giving News Corp a run for their money, right?
Yes, they are trying to dominate the Christian podcasting space. But in any case, do check out that whole family of podcasts in the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Do check out these other shows, or you can get more information about us by visiting christianhumanist.org. We would be grateful if you left us a 100-star review on iTunes. That's a great way to help other people find our show. And you can also like our Facebook page. Visit us on Facebook at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or you can shoot us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Edward Song, and on behalf of Coyle Neal, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway,